Hello, I'm Reno Verricchio. This is number 0606, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0606. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Glenn Frankel is on. He's the author of Shooting Midnight Cowboy, Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic.
Midnight Cowboy was made in the late 60s, a very lively, dangerous, anxious time in our history. Not only our political history, but also in terms of culture and art. The walls were coming down on a lot of barriers from a long time. Hollywood was going under, you know, a lot of changes. They got rid of their old censorship system and put in the rating system, trying to appeal to younger audiences, trying to break down barriers. It was a rich mix for me, and exactly the kind of thing you look for when you do a book like this.
Bruce Olof Solheim is the author of Snark 2, the follow-up to the graphic novel that follows the continuing saga of Snark, an intergalactic traveler, and his companion, Cosmic Staff. How did this story come to him?
Well, it started when I was a prison guard in West Germany. I was in the U.S. Army, U.S. Army jail there, and I was in the guard tower, and it just came to me like a bolt out of the blue, this idea of an alien hybrid character. I kept toying around with the idea, and then after I got out of the military the first time, I went to engineering school, and I needed an extra course to fill out my schedule, so I took school newspaper journalism. I'm an artist, too, as well as a writer, and I asked the editor if I could do a comic strip, and that's where Snark came to life.
Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com is back with the story of Lady Wonder, the Nostradamus of horses.
In 1948, the Chicago Daily Tribune had the, of course, famous erroneous headline, Dewey defeats Truman, which a lot of people thought was the case, and that was what was going to happen. Lady Wonder, however, did predict the Truman victory. This was 1948, though. She'd already been predicting these things for two decades. So people who were in the know about this horse were probably not that surprised that she got that prediction correct.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0606, was Reno Verricchio, who is the co-owner of the podcast station, which is also one of the homes of this very program, the Stuff File program. He's also the host of the Let's Talk Montreal podcast that streams on the podcast station on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Thank you very much, Reno, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? If you think New York City taxi drivers are tough, you haven't watched MTA bus drivers. They have the size and weight and the right-of-way laws behind them. So when a driver on the Brooklyn B35 line tried to make a turn at a busy intersection and another vehicle got in his way, he refused to budge until the other vehicle moved. The other driver, obviously also from the city, wasn't about to give in and also refused to budge. It doesn't get more New York than that, said a nearby resident who witnessed the showdown. The busy intersection was completely blocked during the evening rush hour. Other witnesses tried to negotiate with the two drivers to clear the intersection, but it took several minutes for one of them to give in and move, though it's not clear which one gave up first. Why wasn't the second driver intimidated by the hulking bus bearing down on him, if not for the right-of-way law? Because he was also driving a B35 MTA bus. This is an illustration, the MTA said in an official statement, of why well-enforced bus priority and street parking regulations are so critical to the smooth operation of our buses. Yeah, but You know, common sense is also often more important than the rules. I'm sure there's more to this story than we know. I wouldn't be surprised if those two drivers had history. But still, it's like both of them saw the same spot and conjured up their inner Ralph Cramden, the patron saint of New York bus drivers.
I got 2 seconds, and you better use them to get out! Get out! All right, get out! Get out!
Moving right along, on March 17th, police at the Charleston, South Carolina airport rushed to meet United Airlines Flight 728 in response to a report that someone's ear had been bitten off on the plane, which had been diverted there from its flight from Newark, New Jersey to Miami. 45-year-old passenger John Yurkovich Jr. of New Jersey had become agitated and restless after making the trip to the restroom, then began to scream and thrash around, punching his seatmate and apparently biting the man's ear, which later required 7 stitches. A doctor on board injected Benadryl into Yurkovich's buttocks to help subdue him, and others bound him with zip ties and a belt. Authorities said they found 1.5 grams of suspected meth in Yurkovich's pocket. He was arrested and faces state charges of possession as well as federal charges of assault. You know, when a seatmate on your flight says to you, "Can I have your ear?" I suspect this isn't what most people might think. And apparently, like on social media, on flights, gone are the days of pleasant conversation. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, authorities in Houston charged former Bank of America employee Juan Esteban Ramirez on March 24th with a second felony in connection with tricking young female customers into unlocking their phones so he could steal nude photos of them. In both cases, Ramirez allegedly took the phones to show the women how to look up information on their bank accounts, but with the phones unlocked, he found and sent himself intimate photos. In the second case, Ramirez also texted the woman, who then felt threatened by all of this. Said Harris County Assistant District Attorney Keaton Forst, "It's highly unlikely that these are the only 2 cases. Okay, am I missing something here? Are there a lot of people walking around with phones that contain naked photos of themselves? Have I missed a trend of some kind? And it also seems like a lot of trouble on the part of Juan to trick women into giving their phones over to him in order to text their naked pictures back to himself. I mean, how would he know they even had those pictures to begin with? Plus, have we reached a new level of gullibility here? For me, quite frankly, this story offers up far more questions than it does answers. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Glenn Frankel is back on the show. He was last on with us back in 2017 when his book High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic came out. Well, now Glenn is doing another deep dive. He is the author of Shooting Midnight Cowboy, Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic. Glenn joins us once again on the line from Virginia. Hi, Glenn.
Hi, how you doing, Peter?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. Pleasure to have you back on. When I was a film student, which I was, we spent an entire semester going frame by frame through this particular movie, Midnight Cowboy. So this is right in my wheelhouse. What made you come up with this idea for your next project, for this book?
Well, you know, I had done books about High Noon and The Searchers, 2 classic American Westerns. I was looking for something a little more modern. I've used these books, Peter, not only to write about the making of a great American movie, but to write about the era they were made in and that they reflect. So these books are like half movies and half history, and they sort of shuffle themselves together. And Midnight Cowboy was made in the late 60s, which, as you know, is a very lively, dangerous, anxious time in our history. not only our political history with a certain amount of resonances to today's history, but also in terms of culture and art. I mean, the walls were coming down on a lot of barriers from a long time. Hollywood was going under, you know, a lot of changes. They got rid of their old censorship system and put in the rating system because trying to appeal to younger audiences, trying to break down barriers. And so it was a rich mix for me, and exactly the kind of thing you look for when you do a book like this.
Okay, so the film was actually the winner of the Best Picture at the Academy Awards that year, and it's the only X-rated film to ever win Best Picture at the Academy Awards. So let's back up a little bit. First of all, did it deserve the X rating?
Well, the X rating is a complicated story. It's been told one way over the years about these, you know, prudish censors giving it an X rating because they think it's much too adult with the kind of sex in the movie. But in fact, the raters, the rating board gave it an R originally, and it was United Artists, the studio behind the film, that got queasy about some of the, especially some of the gay sex scenes. There's no nudity, but, you know, it's a pretty raw movie in many ways. And so they gave it the X. But then it went out, and as you say, it won the Academy Award for Best Picture, the only movie ever rated X to win that. And so United Artists turned around then and realized they had a movie that was critically successful. They had a movie that was popular. Midnight Cowboy made good money, and they wanted to take full advantage. So they asked to knock it down to an R, and the ratings board did so without any controversy at all. But what the X rating sort of represented, I think, was just how unusual Midnight Cowboy was, how groundbreaking it was, and how much audiences were ready for that kind of thing in 1969.
Well, let me ask you this. Since it got the X rating, was the X itself actually a curiosity and titillation for those, not necessarily in the general population, but for the movers and shakers behind the business itself and the Academy to give it a harder look?
Well, I think it didn't hurt. I think the folks who marketed the movie were very clever about using the X rating to their benefit. Everything you've heard about Midnight Cowboy is true was one of the taglines in the ad. So yes, to a certain audience, again, a younger audience, an audience looking for something new, this was very appealing. The studio guys, they were all over the place. I mean, they were desperate people in the late 60s. The old genres, including, sadly, the Western, biblical epics, you know, movie musicals, those genres had run out of gas, and they'd run out of appeal. And the audience was getting younger, more college kids, more, you know, people looking for something different. It all came together, not just with Midnight Cowboy. You get a movie like Easy Rider that cost a couple hundred thousand dollars to make, and it makes a fortune, relatively speaking. And The Graduate, I mean, there's suddenly new things are happening. And yes, the X rating really was, in the end, it was an attractive point. It's one of the reasons there were lines out the door. I got to say, though, having Dustin Hoffman, who'd just come off of The Graduate, where suddenly he'd become this kind of, you know, counterculture icon, that didn't hurt either.
Well, you mentioned The Graduate and Dustin Hoffman. The other star of this movie is John Voight, who was at that time a fresh new face. How did the two of them come to these two roles?
It's interesting because, you know, when we look at it now, they look like such naturals for it. Voight's the tall blonde guy and Hoffman's the little ethnic guy playing these interesting characters. But at the time, the director, John Schlesinger, really didn't want either of them. I mean, Hoffman had just become a big movie star, and Schlesinger didn't want to pay the bill for that, and also was afraid this, you know, he didn't see how the guy who played a college grad in The Graduate could look like a down-and-out bum in New York in Midnight Cowboy. But he didn't realize what a great actor Hoffman was. Anyway, they hire Hoffman first, and eventually they settle on John Voight. Even again, this is not the guy Schlesinger really wanted. But these two guys, they come out of New York acting schools. They know what to do with these parts, and they know what to do with each other. They're both competitive, but also collaborative, and they sort of push each other, you know, over the line. And I think that's one of the reasons the movie still resonates, because these guys are just so good. I don't know about you. I can't think of any male performers in a major movie who are better than these two guys.
You mentioned Easy Rider. You mentioned this particular film. Was this also a turning of the page as far as not necessarily young actors are concerned, but young directors?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was a time when nobody knew anything in Hollywood, and when they were interested in new people. I mean, Schlesinger was from the UK. He'd made three or four quite successful movies in Britain, so he wasn't exactly a fresh young thing, and a lot of people wanted to work with him, but they didn't necessarily want to make a movie like Midnight Cowboy about some guy from Texas who comes to New York, think he's going to become a male hustler. I mean, that was a little over the limit, and it took a place like United Artists to be interested. But yeah, they were looking, there was a search out there for rebels, for iconoclasts, for people who might hold the key for Hollywood to recover itself. And the new Hollywood, as it's called, was only for a very brief time, but you get people like Robert Altman making MASH, you get Martin Scorsese in Mean Streets, you get all these interesting sort of experiments, if you will. Some of them work. A lot of them are, you know, don't necessarily make money, but they're part of a new frontier that lasts for a few years. And then the blockbuster came along and everything changed again.
Now, in the case of James Leo Hurley, who wrote the book, and also the director, as you mentioned, John Schlesinger, they were both gay. This goes back to the late 60s. When this is not something that was talked about at all. The fact that you had a gay novelist and a gay director helming this U.S. film, which ended up with an X rating, there were a lot of hurdles to climb, I would assume, in just getting this to the theater in the first place.
Well, it never would have happened 5 or 10 years earlier. I mean, you'd occasionally see a gay character in a movie, and even gay subject matters in a few Hollywood movies, but the gay people involved always either ended up dead or in serious trouble. Being homosexual is bad for your health in a Hollywood movie. It just wasn't anything real. But here we are in an era where the walls have started to come down, and not just in movies. You know, you see The Boys in the Band, the first sort of mainstream gay play, very successful off-Broadway. You see novels of different kinds with different kinds of adult sexuality. Suddenly, the walls have come down. So it was a haul, and neither of these guys, Hurley, he was quite clear on it. This is not a gay novel, and John Schlesinger kept saying this is not a gay movie. But there is an undercurrent, and there is a sort of frank depiction of homosexuality in Midnight Cowboy that you can't deny, and that, in a way, sort of paves the way for much different attitudes and much different movies starting in the 70s. It is a breakthrough, and that's one of the reasons why it was so interesting to write about, because in so many ways, Midnight Cowboy is on the frontier of the future.
Okay, last question, true or false, because this is something that came up when we studied the film oh so many years ago, and that is the famous scene where the cab cuts off Dustin Hoffman and he slams the hood and says, "We're walking here," was an ad lib. The cab shouldn't have been there, and that was not a line.
It was an ad lib, but the cab was in the script. The cab was supposed to be there.
Okay.
But what isn't there is Hoffman's line. That's one that he pulled out himself, and he pulled it out of a hat right as it was happening. So the story's half true, but it's a great story and a great moment, memorable moment.
And it's a great film, and I'm sure this is going to be another one of your great books. This one is called Shooting Midnight Cowboy, Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic. Glenn, I thank you very much once again for being on the program with us.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Peter. Thanks a lot for your time.
Glenn Frankel, author of Shooting Midnight Cowboy, Art, Sex, Loneliness, Liberation, and the Making of a Dark Classic. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0606, and you'll find links to Glenn's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Snark 2, plus Mark Hartzman is in from WeirdHistorian.com with another weird tale, this one for the month of March. We also have more Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day coming your way here on a show that's heard everywhere and on all your devices. On Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. Basically anywhere where you get your podcasts. And it's also heard on several fine radio stations, such as WLSL, LPFM in Dade City, Florida, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, CKLU 96.7 FM in Sudbury, and CKHR Hay River in the Northwest Territories, just to name a few. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? A 34-year-old woman from Jacksonville, Florida, was arrested last week and charged with one count of child abuse with personal special weapon after she allegedly showed up at her daughter's middle school prepared to fight another student with one boxing glove on. Not the student. The woman had the boxing glove. Anyway, Edith Riddle showed up at DuPont Middle School with one boxing glove on to attend a meeting with the vice principal over her daughter's violent outbursts. Gee, I wonder where the daughter gets it from. When asked about why she was wearing the glove on her left hand, Riddle reportedly said that it was glued on and couldn't be removed. After the meeting, Riddle allegedly went to the school's cafeteria with her daughter, who went to egg on another student to fight her. Cops say Riddle's daughter pushed the student to the ground and unleashed a fury of punches. Not wanting to miss out on the fun, the mother also allegedly laid in some haymakers. The victim suffered cuts on her forearms and on her knees and was sent to hospital for evaluation. Isn't it sad when the positive takeaway you can get from a story like this is, well, at least it was only a boxing glove brought to the school and not a gun? But seriously, I think the state needs to separate that mother and daughter until at least a full range of therapy can be completed. And by the way, in this litigious society, how fast do you think the victim's parents are going to sue? Yeah. Well, all it took was one bite of a sausage to solve a nearly decade-old burglary case. Cops in the town of Schwelm, Germany, said the DNA found on a half-eaten piece of sausage matched that of a man who was arrested in France for an unrelated crime. The cops in Germany said the piece of meat belonged to the victim of the burglary and that the 30-year-old suspect allegedly chomped into the piece of it during a March 2012 break-in. It is not known what kind of sausage was involved, although cops hinted it was a hard variety. German cops were notified that their French counterparts had taken a matching DNA sample from a man reportedly involved in a violent crime. However, the German cops say the suspect may escape punishment in the burglary case as the statute of limitations has expired. Well, that certainly is food for thought, isn't it? 29-year-old Robert Raddick of Marlboro, New York, scored a hat trick on March the 7th when he was arrested three times in one day. First stopped that morning in the city of Newburgh, driving a Jeep Cherokee, Raddick was found by the trooper to have a suspended license and crack cocaine with him, for which he was charged with a misdemeanor and released. At 2:30 p.m., the state trooper stopped him again, this time in a Honda Civic, and again found him in possession of crack cocaine along with heroin. His final arrest came at 5:45 p.m. when Radek was stopped driving the Cherokee again and detained after the trooper, and this would be a different trooper than the first two, determined he appeared to be under the influence of drugs. Radek was released with tickets on all three violations and ordered to appear in court in April. You know, I've searched high and low for a picture of Robert, but since he was never booked for any of his three stops of driving without a license while having drugs in his car, and the last time actually being high, well, there's no mugshot since he was never really arrested, right? And the vehicles weren't impounded. I don't want to speculate in the world of news, but that's why I wanted a picture. Because I'm guessing Robert isn't a visible minority. However, I don't want to go out on a limb on that one. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, the bell signifies that it's time to check the Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
A man died after jumping off a Panama City Beach, Florida hotel balcony with a parachute. Guess what didn't happen? Yep. Panama City Beach police received a call late Sunday at Sunrise Beach Resort. Police said a man in his 20s jumped from the 14th floor, and it appeared the parachute didn't deploy. We can assume that he safely traversed the first 13 floors going by, but that the 14th had a real impact on him. It is not known if the man was from Panama City Beach or was an out-of-towner. But regardless, we do know one thing. The Tree of Life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you. I am dead.
Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Snark 2 is now out. It's a graphic novel that follows the continuing adventures of Snark, an intergalactic traveler, and his companion, Cosmic Staff. The mind behind Snark is Dr. Bruce Olav Solheim, who is also a history professor at Citrus College in Glendora, California. Bruce joins us via Skype from Glendora. Hi, Bruce.
Hello, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
Oh, thank you.
So tell us about the origins, first of all, because this is Snark 2. Tell us about the origins of Snark overall.
Well, it started when I was a prison guard in West Germany. I was in the U.S. Army in Mannheim, West Germany, the U.S. Army jail there or prison. And I was in the guard tower, and it just came to me like a bolt out of the blue, this idea of an alien hybrid character. So I kept toying around with the idea. And then after I got out of the military the first time, I went to engineering school at Montana Tech in Butte, Montana, and I needed an extra course to fill out my schedule. So I took school newspaper journalism. I did some, I'm an artist too, as well as a writer. And I asked the editor if I could do a comic strip. And that's where Snark, then spelled with a K, came to life.
Okay, you said when you got out of the military the first time.
Yeah. I did two different tours. Yeah, the first time I was an enlisted man. I was a jail guard for 3 years. And then I was out for about 18 months, although I was in the reserves for much of that time. And then I went active duty again and went to flight school and was a helicopter pilot. So I did a total of 6 years active duty in the U.S. Army.
Okay, so I understand you're born in the United States, but you're born of immigrant Norwegian parents.
Yes.
And I know what it's like to be born of immigrant parents. you know, you've done all of this technical stuff. You've well-educated. You're a professor. What did the family think when you started, you know, writing Snark?
Well, my parents knew I was a writer from a young age. When I was probably 8 or 9 years old, they got me a typewriter, and I started writing. In fact, my parents, my dad, who needed letters written, typed out, would have me type them. Now he couldn't type and he couldn't write in English. He could speak English and read English, but he couldn't write. He didn't have the confidence to do it. So I remember I was typing letters for him, and of course my own little stories and illustrations. So I think they knew that there was something kind of unique about their son. In fact, I was in a typing class in junior high. I was the only boy in the typing class, but I loved it. And I still love writing. So I think they knew. And I wrote a lot of short stories. And sometimes my mom would come in to clean my room and she would read some of the stuff I was writing. And she'd say she'd get so afraid she had to leave the room, you know, because I had all kinds of ideas what I was writing about.
I somehow think we had the same childhood. I used to type all my dad's letters, and I was the only boy in my typing class.
Oh, really? Oh, that's really cool. And your parents are from Barbados, right?
That is correct. Yes.
Yeah, I read something about you. Yeah, I thought interesting background.
So
yeah.
I understand the similarities. That's why I asked the question, because sometimes when you have parents who are immigrants, they don't necessarily like you to go into things that might be creative. They want you to go into a trade or a college-based profession of some kind.
That is true. In fact, that's why I was in engineering school. That's what my dad wanted me to be. It was funny, but I dropped out of engineering school because of my creative endeavors. I spent more time writing and illustrating snark than I did studying calculus. So that was it for my engineering career. I remember when I got my master's degree, my mom was at the ceremony, and this was in 1988. And she said, "This is great." I said, "Mom, aren't you proud of me?" She said, "Yes, it's great. But remember, you always have to have a trade to fall back on." You know, and that's not bad advice, you know, because there's only so many openings for academics, and you got to do something. So that's come in handy to have other trades, other things to do.
So for you, someone who writes snark, and you said you were writing and you were doing the illustrations, which one feeds the other more, the writing of it or the illustrations? In other words, do your illustrations sort of feed the thought process of what you want to write, or is it vice versa?
Well, like in the in this iteration of Snark, now spelled with a C, the comic book, I did a mock-up illustration. So I kind of know how sequential art works because I love comic books. That's how I learned how to read. Comics kind of saved me. So I've been very familiar with how you lay out a comic book. So I would, simultaneously, I would write the dialogue and write the story and do little illustrations. Of course, they're just crude illustrations. And then I would give that then to my partner, Gary Dumb, who's been illustrating professionally comic books since the 1970s, worked with Harvey Pekar and American Splendor and so many other projects. So he is the expert. So then I trust him to take my crude drawings and my story and make it into a beautiful finished comic book. It's really much a team effort. And he understands what I'm trying to say. I understand what he's trying to say. So I'd say it's a synthesis. It's both, really, for me.
So in Snark 2, the journey continues. So tell us a little bit about what that journey is.
Yeah, Snark is an alien hybrid. So he's half human and half alien. He comes to Earth in Snark 1 with a mission. And the mission, unfortunately for us, is to prepare Earth for colonization by his home planet, who are reptilians. Okay, so it's not a good mission. But he gets here and he decides, I really like humans. He has all these adventures. He goes to LA and meets with people, homeless people. He goes to the border and sees what's going on there. He goes to Devil's Tower and meets with Native Americans. He has all these adventures, and he comes to really admire humans. And of course, he is half human. So he then has to face a dilemma. He's not going to be able to complete his mission, and he's going to have to end up protecting us, the humans, from the reptilians. So that's kind of the background. And he has the cosmic staff with him, who is this kind of wisecracking technological stick, if you will, that talks and is very kind of provides the comedy relief for Snark as the straight man. In the second one, it goes further. We find out the background of the cosmic staff, who he really is. And we find out more about Snark's background, his origins, and more about the mission. And it gets, the tension increases as the reptilians actually decide to circumvent. They send somebody else, a reptilian, to help with the, you know, facilitate the invasion or the colonization. And Snark and his friends, assembled a team by that time, have to repel that invasion. So that's what happens in Snark 2.
When you first started writing Snark, did you have or did you envision an entire thought process where or a formula where you had a whole series of stories laid out in your head as to where this saga was going to go? Or did you start with a one-off and then continued?
The original comic strip that was in the Technocrat newspaper at Montana Tech in 1982 I did 5 comic strips. It kind of laid out part of the journey, but it was not a complete vision yet. It was just kind of a start. And I was limited in my artwork, and so I couldn't conceive of all of the incredible things that I wanted him to do. So I was kind of limited in that way. Over the years, I just had it on the shelf, and I just kind of put it out of mind for a while. And then my son got an old copy of the original strip, and he's an engineer, my second oldest son, and he created a 3D or a bust of Snark's head with his 3D printer, and then he forged it because he has a forge too, and he gave it to me for a late Christmas present in January 2019. And that inspired me to get the comic book going. The story then came fully to me, what was going to happen with him, and fleshing it out. And I think the idea of adding the cosmic staff is a very good idea, because having this kind of comedic relief, he's kind of like an innocent abroad. That's kind of what Snark is, if you want to look at a kind of a motif or whatever, or a genre type story. But the cosmic staff kind of grounds him quite a bit. He's always complaining about something, like he always wants to go to Vegas because he loves the Rat Pack. So that because he's been admiring Earth for quite some time. And so he kind of talks like one of the Rat Pack, kind of that hip, cool cat lingo from the 60s.
You know, when people think of history professors, there's a bit of a stereotype that they can be somewhat stuffy, the tweed jacket, leather elbow patches, the whole bit. Do your students think about their history teacher professor being a graphic novelist, or do they know?
No, they know. I offer my comic books as a extra credit if they want extra credit. Everybody wants extra credit. So I said, okay, here, read these comic books. And they love it. They love the stories because it mixes history, social issues, but not in a pedantic way. I don't preach to anybody. And the artwork and science fiction and fantasy and humor. Humor is a big part of Snark, especially the cosmic staff. So they really enjoy it. And also that I wrote a textbook that has comic book pages in it too. Kind of personal things that have happened to me, like in my, I call it making history, because I very much believe in the individual contribution in history. Each of us makes history. Anyway, in each chapter, there's a comic book page drawn by Gary Dumm, written by me, that ties that historical era into a personal experience of mine. Not that I lived during World War I, but some aspect of that I'll bring up in this comic book page. So I've been using comics for a while now, and like I said, I owe my career to comics. I was struggling to read, and my mom allowed me to buy comic books, and that encouraged me, and here I am.
Wow. Do you envision, you obviously want to go on with a series of Snark, but do you envision it leaping from the graphic novel page and being either an animated film or a live action film or television?
Yes. Yeah, no, it's in the works right now. I have a... what we call a stream play production, not a company, but a group of individuals. And we've been putting on, during the lockdown here in the United States, we've been putting on theatrical plays, but live and online. And we're doing our 4th one now. And the 5th one after this one will be Snark. We've already talked about it. It'll be an animation with all the actors that we've been working with. They're very excited about doing voice work on this animation. So yeah, it'll be an animated series next. It'll come out in little vignettes, like 5 to 10 minute stories at a time that we'll release. That'll be animated based on the artwork that Gary Dumm has done. There's going to be more Snark comic books, and there's also a spinoff I've already written. One of the characters is a lady anthropologist. She has a father who was from Ireland, I believe and her mother is from Jamaica. She's an interesting character. I call her Dr. Jekyll, because her last name is Jekyll, and she is the alien hunter. So they meet up. In fact, in Snark 2, they meet up, and then I have a spinoff prequel that'll come out probably before Snark 3. So yeah, there's a whole universe of possibilities with Snark. And the cool thing about it that I like about it is that it's for all ages, so there's nothing inappropriate for younger kids, but there's enough sophisticated stuff there for adults to really enjoy it too. Kind of like the old Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon that you could watch at different levels. And, as an adult, you kind of get humor that you didn't get as a kid, but you still enjoyed it as a kid too. So that's what I'm kind of aiming for, is that all ages kind of thing. And also bringing up social issues in a non-pedantic way and historical events too. Since I'm a historian, I like Snark visits the Gettysburg battlefield, for one thing.
Well, congratulations on the latest edition. It's called Snark 2. It's now out. Bruce, thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. I really, really enjoyed it.
Dr. Bruce Olof Solheim, author of Snark 2. You can go to my website at thestumpfile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0606, and you'll find the link to Bruce's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his graphic novels directly. You're listening to The Stump File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stump File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we will chat with Mark Hartzman from WeirdHistorian.com. We have a few more Stuff File news stories. And, of course, an idiot of the day coming your way here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a 21-year-old man was arrested February 20th. After Indian River County Sheriff's officials in Florida reported he drove as fast as 127 miles per hour on Interstate 95. Asked why he was exceeding 120 miles an hour, the man said, "I was listening to a song called Ciento Vente, which means 120, so I was driving 120. There's some interesting logic. The case began at around 7:25 p.m. as the deputy saw a sedan approaching, dangerously maneuvering in between traffic. The deputy used radar and determined the vehicle was traveling at 117 miles per hour. The vehicle traveled at speeds ranging from 120 to 127 before eventually pulling over after traffic got more congested north of the Vero Beach exit. The driver, a North Lauderdale resident, also is quoted as saying, "I'm sorry, I didn't know driving reckless was illegal." Wow, that's a bold statement. Did he spend his entire childhood watching reruns of The Dukes of Hazzard? When it comes to horsepower, this guy has a lot under the hood, but there's not much horsepower under his hat. In fact, I can think of a horse that's way smarter than him. So let's get to our next guest right now, shall we? Mark Hartzman, curator of the website WeirdHistorian.com, is back with his monthly visit featuring a weird moment in history for the current month. Mark joins us via Skype from New York. And Mark, to paraphrase the words of songwriter Jay Livingston, "A horse is a horse, of course, go right to the source and ask the horse, he'll give you the answer that you'll endorse, he's always on a steady course." And no, we're not talking about Mr. Ed, are we, Mark?
No, this is a horse that could actually do all the things you just said.
Yes.
This is a horse named Lady Wonder, who we're talking about in March, for the month of March, because Lady Wonder passed away in March of 1957. And she predicted her own death, because that's what she did. She could predict the future.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories about this horse is it outdid, I guess, a Chicago newspaper in predicting a particular election.
Yeah, so one of its big moments was in 1948. In 1948, the Chicago Daily Tribune had the, of course, famous erroneous headline, "Dewey defeats Truman," which a lot of people thought was the case. And that was what was going to happen. Lady Wonder, however, did predict the Truman victory. This was 1948, though. She'd already been predicting these things for two decades. So people who were in the know about this horse were probably not that surprised that she got that prediction correct. Lady Wonder was born in 1924, and so she was raised in Richmond, Virginia, in a small, like, red stable. And the woman who raised her, her name was Claudia Fonda. She just kind of recognized a special quality in her when she was a young filly, and really just spent a lot of time, you know, devoting her energy and nurturing this intelligence that she saw in this horse. You know, this horse just became this incredibly intelligent animal that could start to do simple tricks in terms of, like, understanding how to do addition and how to spell things. And the way she would do that is she had these 26 different wooden blocks with different letters on them. And Mrs. Fonda could ask her a question, and Lady Wonder would spell out the answer by moving the blocks with her snout. So she would just push them into position, which was really quite incredible. And then in addition to just being able to understand these things and spell answers and you know, have the numbers also to do the mathematical equations, whether it was subtracting or addition or multiplication, she could also start to predict the future, which, you know, again, it's like, it's pretty incredible. This is a horse, of course. So, you know, how are these things happening? And so, of course, people are starting to come study this. I mean, this was like an event you would go to every day for about 30 years. There were several hours set aside each day that people could come visit Lady Wonder and ask a question and, you know, to their amazement, get the answer. So it was pretty incredible. In 1927, in fact, so when she was still quite young, a man by the name of J.B. Rhine came to visit. And Rhine was on his way to Duke University, and he was starting up the parapsychology lab there, the studies that ended up. He's the guy who invented the term ESP, extrasensory perception. So he was on his way to Duke to kind of kick off this new, you know, learning and studies, and saw the sign for this Lady Wonder, the psychic horse. So he pulled off the road and decided he had to study the psychic horse for a few days before getting on to Duke. And so he did, you know, and he was asking her different questions, kind of simplified questions, spelling questions, math questions, and finding these, you know, amazing answers. Then he ended up blindfolding the horse and found that the horse wasn't as good when the blindfold was on. So it seemed that the horse was somehow responding to signs, very, very subtle cues from Mrs. Fonda, which, even if that's the case, like, okay, the horse didn't really know how to do math or multiplication. I mean, if the horse can read subtle cues and still respond to the proper blocks and put them into position, that's pretty remarkable.
That's also a woman who spent far too much time with a horse, as far as I'm concerned.
That must have been a lot of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Ryan concluded that the horse had some kind of telepathic ability, that it could have some sort of telepathic connection with Mrs. Fonda, or perhaps he thought with anyone asking a question, to understand these different answers.
Well,
he was convinced something was going on.
Didn't the horse also pick a lot of, for instance, sporting events like horse races? I mean, even if he was getting cues from Mrs. Fonda, how would she know the answers?
That's where it gets really amazing, right? And she really earns her name Lady Wonder. Because, yeah, you can see how, like, okay, so maybe there were cues. Maybe it was one of those situations where if Mrs. Fonda knew the answer, the horse could know the answer. Another magician, famous magician and illusionist who wrote lots of books on magic and these kinds of, you know, oddities, his name is Milburn Christopher. He also studied her, and he kind of fooled her. He came in, gave a different name, and the horse spelled out the wrong name because that's the name he gave. The horse didn't know his real name. Again, I mean, it's just a horse, right? But he also thought maybe Fonda was employing a technique called pencil reading. So this, in that case, like a magician would follow the motion of a pencil to see what's been written and then say, oh, you wrote this. So he did that. He did the motion of writing a numeral, the number 9, but actually only wrote a number 1. And of course, Lady Wonder gave the number 9. At this point, by the way, let me just add, she had a typewriter, a giant typewriter set out for her snout to push the keys on. So, you know, they kind of, by this point, they were elevating her showmanship. But to answer your question, yeah, so that's the really crazy thing, is that she did predict, in one case, she picked 28 out of 28 horse races. Maybe she had this telepathic connection with her fellow horses, I don't know. But there's all these amazing things. This was at Baltimore's Pimlico race course. 28 winning horses, it's amazing. And then there's these other accounts as well. there was a story about her helping to find a lost dog that was thought to be dead. And Lady Wonder said this dog was alive in Florida and it belonged to a New York psychologist. And he discovered, after looking into it, he discovered that the Long Island kennel that claimed the dog had died had actually faked the dog's death and sold him for a profit to a place in Florida. And so he found the dog in Florida. And then you had police stations who were reaching out to Lady Wonder. You know how sometimes you hear about the police reaching out to psychics to help them with a case, a missing child, or whatever it may be.
Right.
They were using Lady Wonder for that. And Lady Wonder would actually tell them where to find like a missing body. There was a case where this was a case in Illinois when two boys went missing and Lady Wonder predicted they would be found in the river near their home. And they had already searched this river, but they went back and sure enough, they found the bodies there a few months later. So yeah, I don't know how Mrs. Fonda could know these things. I mean,
well, my first question,
was she guessing a lot and got a few right?
My first question is, does Lady Wonder have an alibi for these missing bodies?
Well, I assume that she never left Richmond.
Okay.
But, I think she was stuck in her barn probably for her life. But yeah, I mean, it really does make you wonder, you know, how was this happening? It's just a remarkable story that this horse, however the horse was doing it, whether she was reading these cues from Mrs. Fonda, you don't have all the answers to explain everything, which is kind of, you know, what's so fascinating about, you know, psychic energy, the possibilities, like, is there something there that we just don't fully understand yet? How could this possibly be? We don't know, but it's that mystery that, like I said, kind of helps her live up to her name of Lady Wonder.
Okay, so as you said, the reason why this is a March story is because it was March that Lady Wonder passed away, and this was also something that she predicted?
Yeah, well, so at one time she predicted that she would die at the age of 30. So by March of 1957, she was 33. So she was pretty close. I'm not sure who asked her when she was going to die. It seems like a weird question if it's your turn. You know, if you're going to visit Lady Wonder, it doesn't seem like the best question to throw at her. But at some point, she gave that prediction.
Wow. So do we know where she's buried?
Yeah, she's buried in Richmond at the Pet Cemetery. It's kind of just nestled away, the little residential area. There's other animals there as well, obviously, the Pet Cemetery. And after that, Mrs. Fonda, she just went into seclusion. So she didn't raise another horse and do more predictions or anything like that. You would think if she had this amazing ability, maybe she would have continued to capitalize on it in some way, but she didn't. It was a special thing she had with Lady Wonder, and that was it.
Well, I'm guessing she was just living off all the money she made from horse racing bets.
She must have done well. I mean, like I said, she had over 150,000 visitors over the years who were coming to talk to Lady Wonder and get these houses. I mean, it's great. Like if anyone goes to my site, weirdhistorian.com, you can see images of the horse, of the typewriter, and the little sign outside the barn. The sign says Lady Wonder horse will spell, add, subtract, multiply, divide, tells time, answers questions. I mean, if I saw that, I'd want to go check it out.
I wonder if Claudia ever watched Mr. Ed.
You know, that's a good question. I guess that would have been on around that time, right?
Yeah, it would have just started.
Thinking like, this guy's got nothing on me.
Exactly. Mark, it's always a delight to have a chance to talk to you. This is a fascinating story. Thank you for being on the program with us once again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Mark Hartzman, author of The Big Book of Mars. His website is weirdhistorian.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0606, and you'll find links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca where you can order his book directly. You'll also find links to Mark's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. I got one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you before we get to our idiot of the day. An unnamed woman had to be rescued by emergency workers after climbing on top of a T-Rex statue at the Granger Dinosaur Park in Washington. The dinosaur park was created in 1993 as an effort to spark interest and tourism in Granger. At one time, the park contained about 30 of the concrete statues of almost every kind of dinosaur, from T-Rex to Velociraptors and more. Apparently, the woman climbed the concrete T-Rex for a photo op and discovered she couldn't climb back down. But according to reports, the woman was able to be safely rescued from the clutches of the fierce T-Rex thanks to a fire crew with a ladder. Oh, the increasingly stupid things people will do all for the sake of a photo op. Which brings us to our next story. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff off presents the idiot of the day.
A visitor at the San Diego Zoo was arrested shortly after taking his 2-year-old daughter into an elephant enclosure. 25-year-old Jose Navarrete made it into the elephant enclosure with his daughter after passing through and over multiple barriers and warning signs. Why did he want to bust in with his infant child to see the elephants? Because he wanted to take a picture. Once the father and daughter were inside the enclosure, an elephant noticed the pair and started to trot towards them. When Jose tried to exit the enclosure with his 2-year-old daughter, he dropped her, but was able to pick her up. You can actually see a video of this on the Stuff File Facebook fan page. There were no injuries to Jose, his daughter, or the elephant. And by the way, one of those fences that he had to hop was an electrified one. Jose was booked into the San Diego County Jail. He is charged with child cruelty and is currently being held on $100,000 bail. Now, why, oh why, would you endanger your own 2-year-old daughter by taking her into an elephant enclosure at the zoo just so you can take a picture? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0606. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0606. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, The Podcast Station, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and CKHR in Hay River. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were to play this episode backwards, go ahead, try and figure that out.